Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. There is a new Middle East, a post-Arab Spring Middle East, but we still don't know what that Middle East looks like and what it's going to look like in the future. But how did we get here? What prompted the Arab Spring? And should we still call it that? Was it really a spring? BBC Bureau Chief Paul Danahar has written the book, The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Bringing together on-the-ground reporting and insightful analysis, Danahar traces the trajectory of politics in Egypt, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Israel, Syria, and Tunisia, raises questions about the future of the region and the world at large. And writing on this book, he brings it's just a compelling book. It's very readable. And I want to thank and welcome Paul Danahar to The Source. Welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much.
So the big question, really, when the Arab Spring, is that really a good term? Should we still call it the Arab Spring?
Well, it's difficult to kind of find a good term for it. It means so many things to so many different people. Some people call them the Arab Awakenings or the Arab Revolts or the Arab Spring. In Israel, they called it the Islamist Awakening, and in other parts of the region, they called it the Sunni Awakening. It's complicated, and I think in many ways, I use the term Arab Spring simply because it was the most widely used term, and it helped people understand it. But it's complicated because this has not been something that's been particularly pleasant or fruitful, and it's certainly been playing out over various seasons. So I think it's a phrase that's useful because people know what you're talking about. But I think we can assume that the weather and the pleasantries of spring have been left behind by the events that have followed.
Yeah, the optimism, the nice, beautiful spring meadow. No, that's not what we ended up with. What did we end up with?
Well, I think to be fair, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember what happened after the fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse of Eastern European communism, can remember that it wasn't very pleasant there either for a few years. What we've ended up with is a much more complicated place than we had before the Arab revolts. In the old days, you could basically deal with the family businesses in Egypt and in Tunisia and in Libya, and you did a deal with the man in charge, and you got what you thought you were going to get. Now they're all gone, and it's become much more complicated. I think the big change in the Middle East, mainly two things. One is that the people of the Middle East have learned that they don't need to sit by and just take what they get. And I think that's a big difference. For 30-odd years, people of the Middle East believed they couldn't change anything, so they didn't. I don't think that will happen again. I don't think the people of the Middle East will be willing to just sit back and have their lives ruled for them by somebody else. I think the other big issue is that religion is going to play a much bigger role in the politics of the region. In the past, the conflicts in the Middle East tended to be about land, about who owned it, whether or not it had been occupied or not by Israel, or whether the Palestinians deserved to get some of their territory back as they saw it. Now a lot of it's going to be fighting over God or the perceived will of God, and that's why we've got a lot of sectarian conflicts in places like Syria. We're seeing Christians across the region increasingly concerned about what kind of place they're going to have in these new societies. So I think the world after the Arab Spring is a lot more complicated, and we will need to be a lot more engaged as Western observers and Western politicians to make sure that it doesn't come back and bite us in the end.
The number to call to join our conversation, if you've got a question or comment, 614-8980, 614-8980. Talking with Paul Danahar in his new book, The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. So first of all, why did it finally happen? You said that people for so long felt like they didn't have control or input into the government, but then it popped. What popped?
Well, what popped was that the generation, the mums and dads of the young revolutionaries had always been looked after relatively well by the state. They got government jobs and government housing, and they got subsidized living. And while they weren't well off, they weren't poor. They weren't facing a pretty hopeless future. The problem was that their sons and daughters were. The state couldn't afford to pay them anymore. It couldn't afford to buy them off. They were looking at a life that was going to be wasted. Now, that was the reason why we had the initial uprising in Tunisia. That was a man frustrated, Mohamed Bouazizi, who was frustrated by the lack of opportunity in his life and by the corruption in his society that stopped him getting on. So what we really had was a new generation of people that saw absolutely no hope, and that gave the encouragement for them to try and do something about it. And at the same time, you had a certain set of circumstances in both Egypt and Tunisia where the ruling family were about to change and create a dynasty, both in Tunisia and in Egypt. And in both those places, the security forces, and this is particularly true in Egypt, began to feel betrayed because in Egypt in particular, all the leaders of Egypt had come from the army, and suddenly it looked like the businessman's son, who'd never been in the army, of Mubarak, was about to be handed power. So you had a kind of coincidence of angry young people with no hope. You had a sense from the instruments of the regime that they were being betrayed, and you had economies seriously damaged by the global downturn and by the rise in food prices. So it all kind of came together, and it needed something to spark it, and that spark came from Tunisia.
It seemed like there was a fear was a big part of it, that the public was afraid of confronting the government and the military in Egypt, but then they stopped being afraid?
They did stop being afraid, and I think a couple of things happened in Egypt. If you look in 2010, at the tail end of 2010, they had elections, and the government always basically cooked the books, but they overcooked them that time, and it meant that nobody got any seats at all that wasn't part of the government. So they tried to cook the books the other way to make it look a bit less embarrassing, and they made a mess there too. So they lost all credibility in terms of trying to project themselves as going down this democratic path. The young people were basically fed up. But I think the other thing is that if you look at the places where you've had revolution that have been successful and the place where you've had revolutions that so far haven't, in Egypt and Tunisia, the old regimes have basically ceased to have any function. They weren't doing anything anymore. They were just kind of existing. But in places like in Syria in particular, the regime still had a function, and that function was to protect the Alawite minority and those businessmen in the Christian community and the Sunni community that had bought into the whole idea of Syria as a kind of pan-Arabist entity. There, the regime had a purpose. It was to protect a group of people unto death, and that's what's been going on. Whereas in Egypt, you know, the old regime had kind of run out of ideas. It didn't really have much to do anymore. And so when the young people pushed against this kind of facade of kind of dictatorial omnipresence, it just fell over.
So we have the list of all the countries where we've seen the turnover in government. And everything still, though, is pretty much copacetic in Saudi Arabia and Jordan. Why did they avoid the Arab Spring?
Well, there's a couple of issues here. Some people say that they believe that it's a fact that these are kingdoms. And so, therefore, the kings can blame their kind of their prime ministers, and they can sack governments and then put new ones in and say, you know, next time it'll be better. So that's what's happened in Jordan. He's got through more than 10 prime ministers since he's been king, which, you know, it's basically a handy way to blame somebody else and then move on. In the Gulf, it's basically money. There is so much money in the Gulf that when you get people that are getting a bit agitated, you drop billions of dollars on the table and you buy them off. Now, the question is, how long is that sustainable? If we see the price of oil go below $100 a barrel, that begins to affect the quality of life of people in the Gulf. It certainly doesn't make them poor, but it does mean that they will be able to say, well, I was better off a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And then they start getting grumpy.
The price of oil did go below $100 a barrel, I'm told, today. We're going to continue this conversation after a quick break. We're talking with BBC Bureau Chief of the Middle East, Paul Danahar, about his book, The New Middle East. This is The Source on KSTX. We will be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new book, The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. The author is BBC Bureau Chief Paul Danahar. So, Paul, let me ask you, you had this comparison between the spring, the Prague Spring, or the Eastern Europe, and how but we saw the countries there kind of break up, and old tensions and old rivalries of came to the fore. Is that what we're seeing in the Middle East with the Arab Spring?
Yes, I think it is. And if you look at the way that the old dictators used to run their societies, they basically created internal strife. So they set communities against each other, they set religions against each other, and they basically said, look, you need me to keep a lid on all of this. I think we are in danger of seeing Syria falling apart. I can see Syria going the way that the former Yugoslavia went. And if you look at where Syria is now, it's almost de facto divided into three areas. You have the areas in the north that is pretty much being controlled by these Islamist groups, al-Qaeda-related groups. And they, if you look at the way that they're fighting, they're not fighting to get down to Damascus. They are fighting to hold on to a sort of statelet in the north of Syria. You have the Assad regime that's hanging on to the coast and to Damascus and the road between the coast and Damascus. And then you have areas around the border with Lebanon and in the south towards Jordan, where the kind of umbrella group of FSA fighters, or Free Syrian Army fighters, as they're called, is holding territory. So you've already got, in many ways, a breakup of Syria. It just hasn't been kind of codified yet. And I think if you do find that Syria does break up, that will have an impact on Iraq, because you'll then have the Kurds being able to create a state of their own, which will put tensions on Iraq. And you're already seeing now the Kurds in Iraq dealing or trying to deal directly with the Turks in terms of oil and that industry. So I think Syria may be the kind of tipping point for a lot of change in the region.
Is that a bad thing for these countries to break up into smaller countries?
Well, it's a bad thing in the sense that it creates more and more confusion and chaos. And if you're concerned about Israel and its protection, then I think it is a bad thing, because the problem that Israel really faces at the moment is that for the first time, it's now faces the prospect of having al-Qaeda groups or al-Qaeda-related groups on its border. I mean, the battles that Israel has always fought over have been primarily about land. It's been Hezbollah denying Israel's right to exist, saying that that land is Palestinian land. Same true for Hamas, same true for the PLO originally. Now, they're going to have people on their border that are fighting over God. And it's much harder to have a negotiation with someone over the will of God than it is over land. And I think if you look in the north, the Syrian border, if you look in the south, with the border with Sinai, which has become a hotbed of Islamic militancy, those two borders have mean a massive change for Israel. That's something they've never had to put up with before. There's always been groups that have been on its borders that they could negotiate either with the people in control via third parties or with the dictators that were basically controlling them by arm's length. Suddenly, they find people on their border, and they don't know who to talk to deal with these people.
Did the American intelligence community have any sense that the Arab Spring was coming?
No, they didn't. And although there was an attempt afterwards to kind of spin it that the Obama administration had kind of worked out this was all going very badly and they had this big policy paper about what to do, it didn't really get very far at all. There was a bit of a kind of internecine squabbling between state and the Defense Department over who took charge over running this thing, and it kind of ran into the ground. So no, but to be fair, everybody was surprised. Even the people that I met on the barricades, whether it be in Tunisia or in Egypt or Syria or Libya, they were all surprised. No one was really expecting it. But it just, you know, it's one of those events, just like the fall of the Soviet Union, that people could intellectually see happening. They just couldn't work out what the trigger was going to be. And when it happened, everyone was pretty much caught by surprise.
And how good is intelligence now about what's happening in the Middle East?
Well, it depends where you are. I mean, the intelligence inside Syria, the Israelis have pretty good intelligence in the areas that are particularly bordering them, because they have such good intelligence inside Lebanon. So the Israelis are fairly well informed about relatively kind of detailed aspects of what's going on in Syria, but obviously not a lot. But for them, it's always been a big problem for them. They've put a lot of effort into that. I think the bigger problem is what's going on in Egypt. Egypt is an incredibly important country in the Arab world, and it seems to be slowly disintegrating in terms of the way that it's running the country. You're seeing more and more violence. You're seeing it moving away from the democratic process, which is very worrying, because what happens in Egypt is often a bellwether for what's going to happen in the rest of the region. And it does seem that America in particular has lost a lot of influence with the army in Egypt. It just seems to be doing its own thing. So unquestionably, again, there's a lot of military links between the Egyptians and the Americans. And I think, you know, on a strategic level, in terms of, you know, are people about to go to war with each other, the intelligence there is very good. But in terms of influencing the politicians about the decisions that they're making, I think America and the West in general has lost an awful lot of influence in that area.
So in Egypt, we did have the revolution, the throwing out of Mubarak. That's after Tunisia. They were second. I'm sure they would have rather have beaten Tunisia to the punch. But then they had the elections, and the Muslim Brotherhood got elected, And then the army had to step in and undo with the junta throwing out that election. So it's very messy.
It's very messy, but I think the big problem is that at the end of the day, love them or hate them, and by the end of their period in power, most people in Egypt hated them. The fact is the Muslim Brotherhood were fairly elected, and that's recognized by all. The problem is that they've been unfairly kicked out. I mean, the American administration doesn't want to use the word coup, but that's exactly what it was, and there's no other way of describing it if you want to be accurate. If a way had been found to have got Morsi out of power using a democratic process, whether that be impeachment or whether it be voting him out, that would have been better for Egypt. Because the problem with the Muslim Brotherhood is when you shine a light on them and bring them out into the open, they proved to be not very competent at all. They were clueless when it came to running the country. And if you'd have allowed them to be voted out, that would have led to a bit of reflection within the Muslim Brotherhood and perhaps a bit of a modernization of the organization. But by pushing them back into the shadows, you basically push them back into their old way of thinking. And the Brotherhood does best when it's in the shadows, being a resistance group working within the bureaucracy of the state. When you pull them out into the open, they have to change and adapt. And I think this is a backward step for Egypt. It's a backward step for the attempts to bring democracy to the region. But I don't think necessarily that we can assume that the army are going to stay in power. They were in power immediately when Mubarak was kicked out, and they were lousy in government too. So the Egyptian people are kind of between a rock and a hard place. So far, they haven't found anyone that knows how to run their country very well.
I know what you're saying about the Muslim Brotherhood, about how they should have been allowed to run the course, and in the next election they could have been ousted if the people thought that that was the right thing to do. But there was a lot of concern that they were subverting democracy while in power and then taking away the women's rights also.
Absolutely, and I'm not talking about the presidential elections. I think what would have been better is if the parliamentary elections had taken place, and I think the Brotherhood would have got hammered in those parliamentary elections, and then a process of impeachment could have started. If you look at what happened with the Brotherhood, they did pretty well in the first parliamentary elections. They got a lot of sympathy votes from people that wouldn't normally have supported them. When it came to the presidential vote, they scraped through with a couple of percent ahead of Shafiq, who was the army man. I suspect that in a second round of parliamentary elections, they would have been hammered. And that would have been a legitimate reason for people to say that they had lost legitimacy in power. Then there would have been a process that I think would have been supported by everyone. And to be fair, the Muslim Brotherhood weren't particularly happy with having Morsi as president because he was a second-choice person. He was uncharismatic. He was not much of a leader. And you could have seen a process where the Brotherhood have said, this guy's not right for any of us. We'll step back, we'll try and reform ourselves, reorganize ourselves, and we'll try again. But it would have been a process whereas people could turn around and say democracy in Egypt was going forward. And I think what's happened now is democracy in Egypt has gone back quite a way.
You've mentioned a couple of times that you think that religion is fueling a lot of this volatility in the Middle East right now. But what about the economy? I mean, if you have a strong economy, if you have jobs, people can get up and go to work each day and they can take care of their family, then they don't have to turn to religion to try and make sense of the world.
Exactly. But the problem is the economies are in such a mess and they're not going to be sorted out anytime soon that religion is then a good way to stir people up and redirect that anger. You're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at the economies going in the Gulf area, they've got tensions themselves. I mean, there's tensions between the Sunni and the Shia Muslims in Saudi Arabia, but because of the amount of money that's being thrown around the country, it's possible to keep them under some kind of control. The problem in places like Egypt and Tunisia is the economies are in a terrible, terrible mess, and it's unlikely to be sorted out any time in the near future. I think one of the big problems for the Arab Spring revolutions was that they happened at a bad time, economically for the whole world. No one had much money to throw towards the Arab countries to try and help them get through this period because they themselves were going through tough times. That wasn't as true during the time of the fall of the Soviet Union. There was more money floating around, not quite to create another Marshall Plan, but at least to try and help build up the institutions of state and give a bit more flexibility to the economy. The problem we've had in the Middle East is the only people that had any money to basically help these countries were countries in the Gulf, and money from the Gulf pretty much always comes with strings attached. And those strings are not very democratic. I mean, you know, there is no democracy in the Gulf. And so it's very hard for us to assume that, you know, money coming from the Gulf is going to be about creating democracy and human rights when it isn't even existing very well in the home states of the country sending the money.
Now, of course, the United States was very nearly dragged into the conflict in Syria, but real quickly now, we managed to avoid that, or have we avoided that? Is that still brewing? So what's next there, do you think?
I can't see America getting involved in Syria. I don't think America would have got involved in Syria beyond dropping some relatively big bombs in a few places. No one believes that America is going to end up with boots on the ground again in the Middle East. It's been too traumatic for the country. I mean, you know, two wars have just consumed this country's economy, consumed people's.
So is the attitude now just let the Middle East burn itself out and then find and reach an equilibrium and then we'll come back and figure out what's left to deal with?
I think that's almost pretty much the policy of America at the moment, yeah.
All right, Paul Danahar, author of the book The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Thank you for being on The Source. Thank you for listening. This is KSTX.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.